Simple questions. Where do you live? And who do you live with? Who pays the bills? And who does the cooking and cleaning? It progressed gradually to more revealing questions. Who do you rely on in your daily life? As in, when you're sick, who does the shopping or takes you to the doctor? Who do you talk to when you are upset? In other words, who provides you with emotional and practical support? Some patients gave us surprising answers. My dog, or my therapist, or nobody. We then asked similar questions about their childhood. Who lived in the household? How often did you move? Who was your primary caregiver? Many of the patients reported frequent relocations that required them to change schools in the middle of the year. Several had primary caregivers who had gone to jail, been placed in a mental hospital, or joined the military. Others had moved from foster home to foster home, or had lived with a string of different relatives. The next section of the questionnaire addressed childhood relationships. Who in your family was affectionate to you? Who treated you as a special person? This was followed by a critical question, one that, to my knowledge, had never before been asked in a scientific study. Was there anybody who you felt safe with growing up? One out of four patients we interviewed could not recall anyone they had felt safe with as a child. We checked nobody on our worksheets and did not comment, but we were stunned. Imagine being a child and not having a source of safety, making your way into the world unprotected and unseen. The questions continued. Who made the rules at home and enforced the discipline? How were kids kept in line? By talking, scolding, spanking, hitting, locking you up? How did your parents solve their disagreements? By then, the floodgates had usually opened, and many patients were volunteering detailed information about their childhoods. One woman had witnessed her little sister being raped. Another told us she'd had her first sexual experience at age 8 with her grandfather. Men and women reported lying awake at night listening to furniture crashing and parents screaming. A young man had come down to the kitchen and found his mother lying in a pool of blood. Others talked about not being picked up at elementary school, or coming home to find an empty house, and spending the night alone. One woman, who made her living as a cook, had learned to prepare meals for her family after her mother was jailed on a drug conviction. Another had been 9 when she grabbed and steadied the car's steering wheel because her drunken mother was swerving down a 4-lane highway during rush hour. Our patients didn't have the option to run away or escape. They had nobody to turn to and no place to hide. Yet they somehow had to manage their terror and despair. They went to school the next morning and tried to pretend that everything was fine. Judy and I realized that the BPD group's problems, dissociation, desperate clinging to whomever might be enlisted to help, had probably started off as ways of dealing with overwhelming emotions and inescapable brutality. After our interviews, Judy and I met to code our patients' answers, that is, to translate them into numbers for computer analysis. And Chris Perry then collated them with the extensive information on these patients he had stored on Harvard's mainframe computer. One Saturday morning in April, he left us a message asking us to come to his office. There we found a huge stack of printouts, on top of which Chris had placed a Gary Larson cartoon of a group of scientists studying dolphins and being puzzled by those strange habla español sounds. The data had convinced him that unless you understand the language of trauma and abuse, you cannot really understand BPD. As we later reported in the American Journal of Psychiatry, 81% of the patients diagnosed with BPD at Cambridge Hospital reported severe histories of child abuse and/or neglect. In the vast majority, the abuse began before age 7. This finding was particularly important because it suggested that the impact of abuse depends, at least in part, on the age at which it begins, Later research by Martin Teicher at McLean Hospital show that different forms of abuse have different impacts on various brain areas at different stages of development. Although numerous studies have since replicated our findings, I still regularly get scientific papers to review that say things like, "It has been hypothesized that borderline patients may have histories of childhood trauma." When does a hypothesis become a scientifically established fact? Our study clearly supported the conclusions of John Bowlby when he wrote, "When children feel pervasively angry or guilty or are chronically frightened about being abandoned, they have come by such feelings honestly. That is because of experience. When, for example, children fear abandonment, it is not a counter-reaction to their intrinsic homicidal urges. Rather, it is more likely because they have been abandoned physically or psychologically, or have been repeatedly threatened with abandonment. When children are pervasively filled with rage, it is due to rejection or harsh treatment. When children experience intense inner conflict regarding their angry feelings, this is likely because expressing them may be forbidden or even dangerous." Bowlby noticed that when children must disown powerful experiences they have had, this creates serious problems, including chronic distrust of other people, inhibition of curiosity, distrust of their own senses, and the tendency to find everything unreal. As we will see, this has important implications for treatment. Our study expanded our thinking beyond the impact of particular horrendous events, the focus of the PTSD diagnosis, to look at the long-term effects of brutalization and neglect in caregiving relationships. It also raised another critical question. What therapies are effective for people with a history of abuse, particularly those who feel chronically suicidal and deliberately hurt themselves? Self-harm. During my training, I was called from my bed at around 3 a.m., three nights in a row, to stitch up a woman who had slashed her neck with whatever sharp object she could lay her hands on. She told me, somewhat triumphantly, that cutting herself made her feel much better. Ever since then, I'd asked myself why. Why do some people deal with being upset by playing three sets of tennis or drinking a stiff martini, while others carve their arms with razor blades? Our study showed that having a history of childhood sexual and physical abuse was a strong predictor of repeated suicidal attempts and self-cutting. I wondered if their suicidal ruminations had started when they were very young, and whether they had found comfort in plotting their escape by hoping to die or doing damage to themselves. Does inflicting harm on oneself begin as a desperate attempt to gain some sense of control? Chris Perry's database had followed up information on all the patients who were treated in the hospital's outpatient clinics, including reports on suicidality and self-destructive behavior. After 3 years of therapy, approximately two-thirds of the patients had markedly improved. Now the question was, which members of the group had benefited from therapy and which had continued to feel suicidal and self-destructive? Comparing the patients' ongoing behavior with our TAQ interviews provided some answers. The patients who remained self-destructive had told us that they did not remember feeling safe with anybody as a child. They had reported being abandoned, shuttled from place to place, and generally left to their own devices. I concluded that if you carry a memory of having felt safe with somebody long ago, the traces of that earlier affection can be reactivated in attuned relationships when you are an adult, whether these occur in daily life or in good therapy. However, if you lack a deep memory of feeling loved and safe, the receptors in the brain that respond to human kindness may simply fail to develop. If that's the case, how can people learn to calm themselves down and feel grounded in their bodies? Again, this has important implications for therapy, and I'll return to this question throughout Part 5 on treatment. The power of diagnosis. Our study also confirmed that there was a traumatized population quite distinct from the combat soldiers and accident victims for whom the PTSD diagnosis had been created. People like Marilyn and Kathy, as well as the patients Judy and I had studied, and the kids in the outpatient clinic at MMHC that I described in Chapter 7, don't necessarily remember their traumas, one of the criteria for the PTSD diagnosis, or at least are not preoccupied with specific memories of their abuse, but they continue to behave as if they were still in danger. They go from one extreme to the other. They have trouble staying on task, and they continually lash out against themselves and others. To some degree, their problems do overlap with those of combat soldiers, but they are also very different in that their childhood trauma has prevented them from developing some of the mental capacities that adult soldiers possessed before their traumas occurred. After we realized this, a group of us went to see Robert Spitzer, who, after having guided the development of the DSM-3, was in the process of revising the manual. He listened carefully to what we told him. He told us it was likely that clinicians who spend their days treating a particular patient population are likely to develop considerable expertise in understanding what ails them. He suggested that we do a study, a so-called field trial, to compare the problems of different groups of traumatized individuals. Spitzer put me in charge of the project. First, we developed a rating scale that incorporated all the different trauma symptoms that had been reported in the scientific literature. Then, we interviewed 525 adult patients at 5 sites around the country to see if particular populations suffered from different constellations of problems. Our populations fell into 3 groups: those with histories of childhood physical or sexual abuse by caregivers, recent victims of domestic violence, and people who had recently been through a natural disaster. There were clear differences among these groups, particularly those on the extreme ends of the spectrum, victims of child abuse, and adults who had survived natural disasters. The adults who had been abused as children often had trouble concentrating, complained of always being on edge, and were filled with self-loathing. They had enormous trouble negotiating intimate relationships, often veering from indiscriminate, high-risk, and unsatisfying sexual involvements to total sexual shutdown. They also had large gaps in their memories, often engaged in self-destructive behaviors, and had a host of medical problems. And these symptoms were relatively rare in the survivors of natural disasters. Each major diagnosis in the DSM had a work group responsible for suggesting revisions for the new edition. I presented the results of the field trial to our DSM-4 PTSD work group, and we voted 19-2 to create a new trauma diagnosis for victims of interpersonal trauma: disorders of extreme stress, not otherwise specified, or DESNOS, or complex PTSD for short. We then eagerly anticipated the publication of the DSM-4 in May 1994. But much to our surprise, the diagnosis that our work group had overwhelmingly approved did not appear in the final product. None of us had been consulted. This was a tragic exclusion. It meant that large numbers of patients could not be accurately diagnosed, and that clinicians and researchers would be unable to scientifically develop appropriate treatments for them. You cannot develop a treatment for a condition that does not exist. Not having a diagnosis now confronts therapists with a serious dilemma. How do we treat people who are coping with a fallout of abuse, betrayal, and abandonment when we are forced to diagnose them with depression, panic disorder, bipolar illness, or borderline personality, which don't really address what they are coping with? The consequences of caretaker abuse and neglect are vastly more common and complex than the impact of hurricanes or motor vehicle accidents. Yet the decision makers who determined the shape of our diagnostic system decided not to recognize this evidence. To this day, after 20 years and 4 subsequent revisions, the DSM and the entire system based on it fail victims of child abuse and neglect, just as they ignored the plight of veterans before PTSD was introduced back in 1980. The Hidden Epidemic. How do you turn a newborn baby, with all its promise and infinite capacities, into a 30-year-old homeless drunk? As with so many great discoveries, internist Vincent Felitti came across the answer to this question accidentally. In 1985, Felitti was chief of Kaiser Permanente's Department of Preventive Medicine in San Diego, which at the time was the largest medical screening program in the world. He was also running an obesity clinic that used a technique called supplemented absolute fasting to bring about dramatic weight loss without surgery. One day, a 28-year-old nurse's aide showed up in his office. Felitti accepted her claim that obesity was her principal problem and enrolled her in the program. Over the next 51 weeks, her weight dropped from 408 pounds to 132 pounds. However, when Felitti next saw her a few months later, she had regained more weight than he thought was biologically possible in such a short time. What had happened? It turned out that her newly svelte body had attracted a male co-worker who started to flirt with her and then suggested sex. She went home and began to eat. She stuffed herself during the day and ate while sleepwalking at night. When Felitti probed this extreme reaction, she revealed a lengthy incest history with her grandfather. This was only the second case of incest Felitti had encountered in his 23-year medical practice. And yet, about 10 days later, he heard a similar story. As he and his team started to inquire more closely, they were shocked to discover that most of their morbidly obese patients had been sexually abused as children. They also uncovered a host of other family problems. In 1990, Felitti went to Atlanta to present data from the team's first 286 patient interviews at a meeting of the North American Association for the Study of Obesity. He was stunned by the harsh response of some experts. Why did he believe such patients? Didn't he realize they would fabricate any explanation for their failed lives? However, an epidemiologist from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, encouraged Felitti to start a much larger study, drawing on a general population, and invited him to meet with a small group of researchers at the CDC. The result was a monumental investigation of adverse childhood experiences, now known as the ACE study, a collaboration between the CDC and Kaiser Permanente, with Robert Anda, M.D., and Vincent Felitti, M.D., as co-principal investigators. More than 50,000 Kaiser patients came through the Department of Preventive Medicine annually for a comprehensive evaluation, filling out an extensive medical questionnaire in the process. Felitti and Anda spent more than a year developing 10 new questions covering carefully defined categories of adverse childhood experiences, including physical and sexual abuse, physical and emotional neglect, and family dysfunction, such as having had parents who were divorced, mentally ill, addicted, or in prison. They then asked 25,000 consecutive patients if they would be willing to provide information about childhood events. 17,421 said yes. Their responses were then compared with the detailed medical records that Kaiser kept on all patients. The ACE study revealed that traumatic life experiences during childhood and adolescence are far more common than expected. The study respondents were mostly white, middle-class, middle-aged, well-educated, and financially secure enough to have good medical insurance. And yet only one-third of the respondents reported no adverse childhood experiences. Here are some other findings from the study. 1. 1 out of 10 individuals responded yes to the question, "Did a parent or other adult in the household often or very often swear at you, insult you, or put you down?" 2. More than a quarter responded yes to the questions, "Did one of your parents often or very often push, grab, slap, or throw something at you?" And, "Did one of your parents often or very often hit you so hard that you had marks or were injured?" In other words, more than a quarter of the U.S. population is likely to have been repeatedly physically abused as a child. 3. To the questions, did an adult or person at least 5 years older ever have you touch their body in a sexual way? And did an adult or person at least 5 years older ever attempt oral, anal, or vaginal intercourse with you? 28% of women and 16% of men responded affirmatively. And finally, 4, 1 in 8 people responded positively to the questions, as a child, did you witness your mother sometimes, often, or very often, pushed, grabbed, slapped, or had something thrown at her? And, as a child, did you witness your mother sometimes, often, or very often, kicked, bitten, hit with a fist, or hit with something hard? Each yes answer was scored as 1 point, leading to a possible ACE score ranging from 0 to 10. For example, a person who experienced frequent verbal abuse, who had an alcoholic mother, and whose parents divorced, would have an ACE score of 3. Of the 2/3 of respondents who reported an adverse experience, 87% scored 2 or more. 1 in 6 of all respondents had an ACE score of 4 or higher. In short, Felidi and his team had found that adverse experiences are interrelated, even though they are usually studied separately. People typically don't grow up in a household where one brother is in prison but everything else is fine. They don't live in families where their mother is regularly beaten but life is otherwise hunky-dory. Incidents of abuse are never standalone events, and for each additional adverse experience reported, the toll in later damage increases. Felitti and his team found that the effects of childhood trauma first become evident in school. More than half of those with ACE scores of 4 or higher reported having learning or behavioral problems, compared with 3% of those with a score of 0. As the children matured, they didn't outgrow the effects of their early experiences. As Felitti notes, traumatic experiences are often lost in time and concealed by shame, secrecy, and social taboo. But the study revealed that the impact of trauma pervaded these patients' adult lives. For example, high ACE scores turned out to correlate with higher workplace absenteeism, financial problems, and lower lifetime income. When it came to personal suffering, the results were devastating. As the ACE score rises, chronic depression in adulthood also rises dramatically. For those with an ACE score of 4 or more, its prevalence is 66% in women and 35% in men, compared with an overall rate of 12% in those with an ACE score of 0. The likelihood of being on antidepressant medication or prescription painkillers also rose proportionally. As Felitti has pointed out, we may be treating today experiences that happened 50 years ago, at ever-increasing cost. Antidepressant drugs and painkillers constitute a significant portion of our rapidly rising national healthcare expenditures. Ironically, research has shown that depressed patients without prior histories of abuse or neglect tend to respond much better to antidepressants than patients with those backgrounds. Self-acknowledged suicide attempts rise exponentially with ACE scores. From a score of 0 to a score of 6, there's about a 5,000% increased likelihood of suicide attempts. The more isolated and unprotected a person feels, the more death will feel like the only escape. When the media report an environmental link to a 30% increase in the risk of some cancer, it is headline news. Yet these far more dramatic figures are overlooked. As part of their initial medical evaluation, study participants were asked, "Have you ever considered yourself to be an alcoholic?" People with an ACE score of 4 were 7 times more likely to be alcoholic than adults with a score of 0. Injection drug use increased exponentially. For those with an ACE score of 6 or more, the likelihood of IV drug use was 4,600% greater than in those with a score of 0. Women in the study were asked about rape during adulthood. At an ACE score of 0, the prevalence of rape was 5%. At a score of 4 or more, it was 33%. Why are abused or neglected girls so much more likely to be raped later in life? The answers to this question have implications far beyond rape. For example, numerous studies have shown that girls who witness domestic violence while growing up are at much higher risk of ending up in violent relationships themselves, while for boys who witness domestic violence, the risk that they will abuse their own partners rises sevenfold. More than 12% of study participants had seen their mothers being battered. The list of high-risk behaviors predicted by the ACE score included smoking, obesity, unintended pregnancies, multiple sexual partners, and sexually transmitted diseases. Finally, the toll of major health problems was striking. Those with an ACE score of 6 or above had a 15% or greater chance than those with an ACE score of 0 of currently suffering from any of the 10 leading causes of death in the United States, including chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, ischemic heart disease, and liver disease. They were twice as likely to suffer from cancer and four times as likely to have emphysema. The ongoing stress on the body keeps taking its toll. When problems are really solutions. 12 years after he originally treated her, Felitti again saw the woman whose dramatic weight loss and gain had started him on his quest. She told him that she'd subsequently had bariatric surgery, but after she'd lost 96 pounds, she'd become suicidal. It had taken 5 psychiatric hospitalizations and 3 courses of electroshock to control her suicidality. Felitti points out that obesity, which is considered a major public health problem, may in fact be a personal solution for many. Consider the implications. If you mistake someone's solution for a problem to be eliminated, not only are they likely to fail treatment, as often happens in addiction programs, but other problems may emerge. One female rape victim told Felitti, "Overweight is overlooked, and that's the way I need to be." Weight can protect men as well. Felitti recalls 2 guards at a state prison in his obesity program. They promptly regained the weight they had lost because they felt a lot safer being the biggest guy on the cell block. Another male patient became obese after his parents divorced, and he moved in with his violent, alcoholic grandfather. He explained, "It wasn't that I ate because I was hungry and all of that. It was just a place for me to feel safe. All the way from kindergarten, I used to get beat up all the time. When I got the weight on, it didn't happen anymore." The ACE study group concluded, "Although widely understood to be harmful to health, each adaptation, such as smoking, drinking, drugs, obesity, is notably difficult to give up. Little consideration is given to the possibility that many long-term health risks might also be personally beneficial in the short term. We repeatedly hear from patients of the benefits of these health risks. The idea of the problem being a solution, while understandably disturbing to many, is certainly in keeping with the fact that opposing forces routinely coexist in biological systems. What one sees, the presenting problem, is often only the marker for the real problem, which lies buried in time, concealed by patient shame, secrecy, and sometimes amnesia, and, frequently, clinician discomfort. Child abuse, our nation's largest public health problem. The first time I heard Robert Anda present the results of the ACE study, he could not hold back his tears. In his career at the CDC, he had previously worked in several major risk areas, including tobacco research and cardiovascular health. But when the ACE study data started to appear on his computer screen, he realized that they had stumbled upon the gravest and most costly public health issue in the United States, child abuse. He had calculated that its overall costs exceeded those of cancer or heart disease, and that eradicating child abuse in America would reduce the overall rate of depression by more than half, alcoholism by 2/3, and suicide, IV drug use, and domestic violence by 3/4. It would also have a dramatic effect on workplace performance and vastly decrease the need for incarceration. When the Surgeon General's report on smoking and health was published in 1964, it unleashed a decades-long legal and medical campaign that has changed daily life and long-term health prospects for millions. The number of American smokers fell from 42% of adults in 1965 to 19% in 2010, and is estimated that nearly 800,000 deaths from lung cancer were prevented between 1975 and 2000. The ACE study, however, has had no such effect. Follow-up studies and papers are still appearing around the world, but the day-to-day reality of children like Marilyn, and the children in outpatient clinics and residential treatment centers around the country, remains virtually the same. Only now they receive high doses of psychotropic agents, which makes them more tractable, but which also impairs their ability to feel pleasure and curiosity, to grow and develop emotionally and intellectually, and to become contributing members of society. Chapter 10. Developmental Trauma, The Hidden Epidemic. The notion that early childhood adverse experiences lead to substantial developmental disruptions is more clinical intuition than a research-based fact. There is no known evidence of developmental disruptions that were preceded in time in a causal fashion by any type of trauma syndrome. From the American Psychiatric Association's rejection of a developmental trauma disorder diagnosis, May 2011. Research on the effects of early maltreatment tells a different story, that early maltreatment has enduring negative effects on brain development. Our brains are sculpted by our early experiences. Maltreatment is a chisel that shapes a brain to contend with strife, but at the cost of deep, enduring wounds. Childhood abuse isn't something you get over. It is an evil that we must acknowledge and confront if we aim to do anything about the unchecked cycle of violence in this country. Martin Teicher, MD, PhD, from Scientific American. There are hundreds of thousands of children like the ones I am about to describe, and they absorb enormous resources, often without appreciable benefit. They end up filling our jails, our welfare rolls, and our medical clinics. Most of the public knows them only as statistics. Tens of thousands of school teachers, probation officers, welfare workers, judges, and mental health professionals spend their days trying to help them, and the taxpayer pays the bills. Anthony was only 2 and a half when he was referred to our trauma center by a child care center because its employees could not manage his constant biting and pushing, his refusal to take naps, and his intractable crying, headbanging, and rocking. He did not feel safe with any staff member, and fluctuated between despondent collapse and angry defiance. When we met with him and his mother, he anxiously clung to her, hiding his face, while she kept saying, "Don't be such a baby." He startled when a door banged somewhere down the corridor, and then burrowed deeper into his mom's lap. When she pushed him away, he sat in a corner and started to bang his head. "He just does that to bug me," his mother remarked. When we asked about her own background, she told us that she'd been abandoned by her parents and raised by a series of relatives who hit her, ignored her, and started to sexually abuse her at age 13. She'd become pregnant by a drunken boyfriend who left her when she told him she was carrying his child. Anthony was just like his father, she said, a good-for-nothing. She had had numerous violent rows with subsequent boyfriends, but she was sure that this had happened too late at night for Anthony to notice. If Anthony were admitted to a hospital, he would likely be diagnosed with a host of different psychiatric disorders: depression, oppositional defiant disorder, anxiety, reactive attachment disorder, ADHD, and PTSD. None of these diagnoses, however, would clarify what was wrong with Anthony: that he was scared to death and fighting for his life, and he did not trust that his mother could help him. Then there's Maria, a 15-year-old Latina, one of the more than 500,000 kids in the United States that grow up in foster care and residential treatment programs. Maria is obese and aggressive. She has a history of sexual, physical, and emotional abuse and has lived in more than 20 out-of-home placements since age 8. The pile of medical charts that arrived with her describe her as mute, vengeful, impulsive, reckless, and self-harming, with extreme mood swings and an explosive temper. She describes herself as garbage, worthless, rejected. After multiple suicide attempts, Maria was placed in one of our residential treatment centers. Initially, she was mute and withdrawn and became violent when people got too close to her. After other approaches failed to work, she was placed in an equine therapy program where she groomed her horse daily and learned simple dressage. 2 years later, I spoke with Maria at her high school graduation. She had been accepted by a 4-year college. When I asked her what had helped her most, she answered, "The horse I took care of." She told me that she first started to feel safe with her horse. He was there every day, patiently waiting for her, seemingly glad upon her approach. She started to feel a visceral connection with another creature and began to talk to him like a friend. Gradually, she started talking with other kids in the program and, eventually, with her counselor. Virginia is a 13-year-old adopted white girl. She was taken away from her biological mother because of the mother's drug abuse. After her first adoptive mother fell ill and died, she moved from foster home before being adopted again. Virginia was seductive with any male who crossed her path, and she reported sexual and physical abuse by various babysitters and temporary caregivers. She came to our residential treatment program after 13 crisis hospitalizations for suicide attempts. The staff described her as isolated, controlling, explosive, sexualized, intrusive, vindictive, and narcissistic. She described herself as disgusting and said she wished she were dead. The diagnoses in her chart were bipolar disorder, intermittent explosive disorder, reactive attachment disorder, attention deficit disorder, ADD, hyperactivity subtype, oppositional defiant disorder, or ODD, and substance abuse disorder. But who really is Virginia? How can we help her have a life? We can hope to solve the problems of these children only if we correctly define what is going on with them, and do more than developing new drugs to control them, or try to find the gene that is responsible for their disease. The challenge is to find ways to help them lead productive lives and, in doing so, save hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer money. That process starts with facing the facts. Bad genes? With such pervasive problems and such dysfunctional parents, we would be tempted to ascribe their problems simply to bad genes. Technology always produces new directions for research, and when it became possible to do genetic testing, psychiatry became committed to finding the genetic causes of mental illness. Finding a genetic link seemed particularly relevant for schizophrenia, a fairly common, affecting about 1% of the population, severe and perplexing form of mental illness, and one that clearly runs in families. And yet, after 30 years and millions upon millions of dollars worth of research, we have failed to find consistent genetic patterns for schizophrenia, or for any other psychiatric illness, for that matter. Some of my colleagues have also worked hard to discover genetic factors that predispose people to develop dramatic stress. That quest continues, but so far, it has failed to yield any solid answers. Recent research has swept away the simple idea that having a particular gene produces a particular result. It turns out that many genes work together to influence a single outcome. Even more important, genes are not fixable. Life events can trigger biochemical messages that turn them on or off by attaching methyl groups, a cluster of carbon and hydrogen atoms, to the outside of the gene, a process called methylation, making it more or less sensitive to messages from the body. While life events can change the behavior of the gene, they don't alter its fundamental structure. Methylation patterns, however, can be passed on to offspring, a phenomenon known as epigenetics. Once again, the body keeps the score at the deepest levels of the organism. One of the most cited experiments in epigenetics was conducted by McGill University researcher Michael Meany, who studies newborn rat pups and their mothers. He discovered that how much a mother rat licks and grooms her pups during the first 12 hours after their birth permanently affects the brain chemicals that respond to stress and modifies the configuration of over 1,000 genes. The rat pups that are intensively licked by their mothers are braver and produce lower levels of stress hormones under stress than rats whose mothers are less attentive. They also recover more quickly, an equanimity that lasts throughout their lives. They develop thicker connections in the hippocampus, a key center for learning and memory, and they perform better in an important rodent skill, finding their way through mazes. We are just beginning to learn that stressful experiences affect gene expressions in humans as well. Children whose pregnant mothers had been trapped in unheated houses in a prolonged ice storm in Quebec had major epigenetic changes compared with the children of mothers whose heat had been restored within a day. McGill researcher Moshe Jiff compared the epigenetic profiles of hundreds of children born into the extreme ends of social privilege in the United Kingdom and measured the effects of child abuse on both groups. Differences in social class were associated with distinctly different epigenetic profiles, but abused children in both groups had in common specific modifications in 73 genes. In Jiff's words, major changes to our bodies can be made not just by chemicals and toxins, but also in the way the social world talks to the hardwired world. Monkeys clarify old questions about nature versus nurture. One of the clearest ways of understanding how the quality of parenting and environment affects the expression of genes comes from the work of Stephen Somi, chief of the National Institutes of Health's Laboratory of Comparative Ethology. For more than 40 years, Somi has been studying the transmission of personality through generations of rhesus monkeys, which share 95% of human genes, a number exceeded only by chimpanzees and bonobos. Like humans, rhesus monkeys live in large social groups with complex alliances and status relationships, and only members who can synchronize their behavior with the demands of the troop survive and flourish. Rhesus monkeys are also like humans in their attachment patterns. Their infants depend on intimate physical contact with their mothers, and just as Bowlby observed in humans, they develop by exploring their reactions to their environment, running back to their mothers whenever they feel scared or lost. Once they become more independent, play with their peers is the primary way they learn to get along in life. Somi identified two personality types that consistently ran into trouble: uptight, anxious monkeys who become fearful, withdrawn, and depressed even in situations where other monkeys will play and explore, and highly aggressive monkeys who make so much trouble that they are often shunned, beaten up, or killed. Both types are biologically different from their peers. Abnormalities in arousal levels, stress hormones, and metabolism of brain chemicals like serotonin can be detected within the first few weeks of life, and neither their biology nor their behavior tends to change as they mature. Somi discovered a wide range of genetically driven behaviors. For example, the uptight monkeys, classified as such on the basis of their behavior and their high cortisol levels at 6 months, will consume more alcohol in experimental situations than others when they reach the age of 4. The genetically aggressive monkeys will also overindulge, but they binge drink to the point of passing out, while the uptight monkeys seem to drink to calm down. And yet the social environment also contributes significantly to behavior and biology. The uptight, anxious females don't play well with others, and thus often lack social support when they give birth, and are at high risk for neglecting or abusing their firstborns. But when these females belong to a stable social group, they often become diligent mothers who carefully watch out for their young, Under some conditions, being an anxious mom can provide much-needed protection. Aggressive mothers, on the other hand, don't provide any social advantages. Very punitive with their offspring, there is lots of hitting, kicking, and biting. If the infants survive, their mothers usually keep them from making friends with their peers. In real life, it is impossible to tell whether people's aggressive or uptight behavior is the result of parents' genes or of having been raised by an abusive mother, or both. But in a monkey lab, you can take newborns with vulnerable genes away from their biological mothers and have them raised by supportive mothers or in playgroups with peers. Young monkeys who are taken away from their mothers at birth and brought up solely with their peers become intensely attached to them. They desperately cling to one another and don't peel away enough to engage in healthy exploration and play. What little play there is lacks the complexity and imagination typical of normal monkeys. These monkeys grow up to be uptight, scared in new situations, and lacking in curiosity. Regardless of their genetic predisposition, peer-raised monkeys overreact to minor stresses. Their cortisol increases much more in response to loud noises than does that of monkeys who are raised by their mothers. Their serotonin metabolism is even more abnormal than that of the monkeys who are genetically predisposed to aggression, but who are raised by their own mothers. This leads to the conclusion that, at least in monkeys, early experience has at least as much impact on biology as heredity does. Monkeys and humans share the same two variants of the serotonin gene, known as the short and long serotonin transporter alleles. In humans, the short allele has been associated with impulsivity, aggression, sensation-seeking, suicide attempts, and severe depression. Suomi showed that, at least in monkeys, the environment shapes how these genes affect behavior. Monkeys with a short allele that were raised by an adequate mother behaved normally and had no deficit in their serotonin metabolism. Those who were raised with their peers became aggressive risk-takers. Similarly, New Zealand researcher Alec Roy found that humans with the short allele had higher rates of depression than those with the long version, but that this was true only if they also had a childhood history of abuse or neglect. The conclusion is clear. Children who are fortunate enough to have an attuned and attentive parent are not going to develop this genetically related problem. Suomi's work supports everything we've learned from our colleagues who study human attachment and from our own clinical research. Safe and protective early relationships are critical to protect children from long-term problems. In addition, even parents with their own genetic vulnerabilities can pass on that protection to the next generation, provided that they are given the right support. The National Child Traumatic Stress Network. Nearly every medical disease, from cancer to retinitis pigmentosa, has advocacy groups that promote the study and treatment of that particular condition. But until 2001, when the National Child Traumatic Stress Network was established by an act of Congress, there was no comprehensive organization dedicated to the research and treatment of traumatized children. In 1998, I received a call from Adam Cummings from the Nathan Cummings Foundation, telling me that they were interested in studying the effects of trauma on learning. I told them that while some very good work had been done on that subject, there was no forum to implement the discoveries that had already been made. The mental, biological, or moral development of traumatized children was not being systematically taught to child care workers, to pediatricians, or in graduate schools of psychology or social work. Adam and I agreed that we had to address this problem. Some 8 months later, we convened a think tank that included representatives from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the U.S. Department of Justice, Senator Ted Kennedy's health care advisor, and a group of my colleagues who specialized in childhood trauma. We all were familiar with the basics of how trauma affects the developing mind and brain, and we were all aware that childhood trauma is radically different from traumatic stress in fully formed adults. The group concluded that if we hope to ever put the issue of childhood trauma firmly on the map, There needed to be a national organization that would promote both the study of childhood trauma and the education of teachers, judges, ministers, foster parents, physicians, probation officers, nurses, and mental health professionals. Anyone who deals with abusive and traumatized kids. One member of our work group, Bill Harris, had extensive experience with child-related legislation, and he went to work with Senator Kennedy's staff to craft our ideas into law. The bill establishing the National Child Traumatic Stress Network was ushered through the Senate with overwhelming bipartisan support, and since 2001, it has grown from a collaborative network of 17 sites to more than 150 centers nationwide. Led by coordinating centers at Duke University and UCLA, the NCTSN includes universities, hospitals, tribal agencies, drug rehab programs, mental health clinics, and graduate schools. Each of the sites, in turn, collaborates with local school systems, hospitals, welfare agencies, homeless shelters, juvenile justice programs, and domestic violence centers, with a total of well over 8,300 affiliated partners. Once the NCTSN was up and running, we had the means to assemble a clearer profile of traumatized kids in every part of the country. My trauma center colleague, Joseph Spinazzola, led a survey that examined the records of nearly 2,000 children and adolescents from agencies across the network. We soon confirmed what we had suspected. The vast majority came from extremely dysfunctional families. More than half had been emotionally abused and/or had a caregiver who was too impaired to care for their needs. Almost 50% had temporarily lost caregivers to jail, treatment programs, or military service, and had been looked after by strangers, foster parents, or distant relatives. About half reported having witnessed domestic violence, and a quarter were also victims of sexual and/or physical abuse. In other words, the children and adolescents in the survey were mirrors of the middle-aged, middle-class, Kaiser Permanente patients with high ACE scores that Vincent Felitti had studied in the Adverse Childhood Experiences, or ACE, study. The power of diagnosis. In the 1970s, there was no way to classify the wide-ranging symptoms of hundreds of thousands of returning Vietnam veterans. As we saw in the opening chapters of this book, this forced clinicians to improvise the treatment of their patients and prevented them from being able to systematically study what approaches actually worked. The adoption of the PTSD diagnosis by the DSM-3 in 1980 led to extensive scientific studies and to the development of effective treatments, which turned out to be relevant not only to combat veterans, but also to victims of a range of traumatic events, including rape, assault, and motor vehicle accidents. An example of the far-ranging power of having a specific diagnosis is the fact that between 2007 and 2010, the Department of Defense spent more than $2.7 billion for the treatment and research on PTSD in combat veterans, while in fiscal year 2009 alone, the Department of Veterans Affairs spent $24.5 million on in-house PTSD research. The DSM definition of PTSD is quite straightforward. A person is exposed to an horrendous event that involved actual or threatened death or serious injury, or a threat to the physical integrity of self or others, causing intense fear, helplessness, or horror, which results in a variety of manifestations. Intrusive re-experiencing of the event, meaning flashbacks, bad dreams, feeling as if the event were occurring. Persistent and crippling avoidance of people, places, thoughts, or feelings associated with the trauma, sometimes with amnesia for important parts of it. And increased arousal, meaning insomnia, hypervigilance, or irritability. This description suggests a clear storyline. A person is suddenly and unexpectedly devastated by an atrocious event and is never the same again. The trauma may be over, but it keeps being replayed in continually recycling memories and in a reorganized nervous system. How relevant was this definition to the children we were seeing? After a single traumatic incident, a dog bite, an accident, or witnessing a school shooting, children can indeed develop basic PTSD symptoms similar to those of adults, even if they live in safe and supportive homes. As a result of having the PTSD diagnosis, we now can treat those problems quite effectively. In the case of the troubled children with histories of abuse and neglect who show up in clinics, schools, hospitals, and police stations, the traumatic roots of their behaviors are less obvious, particularly because they rarely talk about having been hit, abandoned, or molested even when asked. 82% of the traumatized children seen in the National Child Traumatic Stress Network do not meet diagnostic criteria for PTSD. Because they often are shut down, suspicious, or aggressive, they now receive pseudoscientific diagnoses such as oppositional defiant disorder, meaning, this kid hates my guts and won't do anything I tell him to do, or disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, meaning, he has temper tantrums. Having as many problems as they do, these kids accumulate numerous diagnoses over time. Before they reach their 20s, many patients have been given 4, 5, 6, or more of these impressive but meaningless labels. If they receive treatment at all, they get whatever is being promulgated as the method of management du jour: medications, behavioral modification, or exposure therapy. These rarely work and often cause more damage. As the NCTSN treated more and more kids, it became increasingly obvious that we needed a diagnosis that captured the reality of their experience. We began with a database of nearly 20,000 kids who were being treated in various sites within the network and collected all the research articles we could find on abused and neglected kids. These were winnowed down to 130 particularly relevant studies that reported on more than 100,000 children and adolescents worldwide. A core work group of 12 clinician researchers specializing in childhood trauma then convened twice a year for 4 years to draft a proposal for an appropriate diagnosis, which we decided to call developmental trauma disorder. As we organized our findings, we discovered a consistent profile. 1. A pervasive pattern of dysregulation. 2. Problems with attention and concentration. And 3. Difficulties getting along with themselves and others. These children's moods and feelings rapidly shifted from one extreme to another, from temper tantrums and panic to detachment, flatness, and dissociation. When they got upset, which was much of the time, they could neither calm themselves down nor describe what they were feeling. Having a biological system that keeps pumping out stress hormones to deal with real or imagined threats leads to physical problems, such as sleep disturbances, headaches, unexplained pain, oversensitivity to touch or sound. Being so agitated or shut down keeps them from being able to focus their attention and concentration. To relieve their tension, they engage in chronic masturbation, rocking, or self-harming activities such as biting, cutting, burning, and hitting themselves, pulling out their hair, or picking at their skin until it bled. It also leads to difficulties with language processing and fine motor coordination. Spending all their energy on staying in control, they usually have trouble paying attention to things like schoolwork that are not directly relevant to survival, and their hyperarousal makes them easily distracted. Having been frequently ignored or abandoned leaves them clinging and needy, even with the people who have abused them. Having been chronically beaten, molested, and otherwise mistreated, they cannot help but define themselves as defective and worthless. They come by their self-loathing, sense of defectiveness, and worthlessness, honestly. Was it any surprise that they didn't trust anyone? Finally, the combination of feeling fundamentally despicable and overreacting to slight frustrations makes it difficult for them to make friends. We published the first articles about our findings, developed a validated rating scale, and collected data